The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. We've been discussing on the last several programs something of the idea of the statistical difficulties that are involved in an evolutionary view of a cell, an organism, the universe. For the last program or so, we have been talking about a reasonably widespread, widely reproduced statement by a Nobel Prize winner by the name of George Wald. Let me repeat that comment for you, please. Quote, time is the hero of the plot. The time here he's referring to, the plot, of course, is the idea of evolution. Given enough time, anything can happen. The impossible becomes probable. The improbable becomes certain. And then we had looked at Julian Huxley's, or at least an allusion to the statement by Julian Huxley, discussing the idea. My recollection of the actual comment was that if you had a number of monkeys equivalent to the population of the Earth that were typing on typewriters for the time period of the Earth, the age of the Earth, 4.6 billion years, that in that time they would have reproduced Shakespeare's works. Don't hold me too tightly to that, but it seems to me that's the framework of the statement itself. And we had looked then at a comment by Mr. Sunderland involving that illustration. Prominent evolutionist Julian Huxley has stated that given enough time, monkeys typing on typewriters could eventually type out the complete works of Shakespeare. Such uninformed statements have a dramatic effect on the layman, and even persons who have mathematical background to know better often fail to make the simple calculations that would reveal the ridiculousness of the conjecture. For example, if there were monkeys typing on typewriters covering every square foot of the Earth's surface, and each one typed at random at the fantastic rate of 10 characters a second for 30 billion years, there would not be the slightest reasonable chance that a single one would type out a single specific five-word sentence of 31 letters, spaces, and punctuation. The actual probability would be, actual probability is less than one chance in a trillion. Yet Huxley was permitted to make the preposterous statement that monkeys could type out the complete works of Shakespeare, and no evolutionary scientist or mathematician who knew better raised a single objection. Now, I would like to go on here with Mr. Sunderland's comments, and then we will come back to some other things in a moment. If you remember, last time we looked at a comment which was defining the idea of statistical probability and what never means. And that definition certainly includes the idea of this illustration. As we're getting ready to establish again, this is just something that could not possibly happen. Now, Mr. Sunderland's comments, time definitely is not the hero of the plot. In reality, time destroys the assumption of the evolutionary theory. Even the 20 billion years assumed since the Big Bang. If a single five-word sentence could not be formed in more time than the Earth has existed, it is even less conceivable that the data contained in the genes of a single cell could have formed by random processes, because the genes of the simplest single-celled organism contain more data than there are letters in all of the volumes in the world's largest library. Now, Huxley's illustration here, talking about Shakespeare's works, as opposed to all of the books contained in all of the letters contained in all of the words in all of the books in the world's largest library, are more than that illustration itself. when you sit down and do some thinking and do some mathematics, it becomes very apparent that the statistics of this are not just improbable, they are impossible. Now back to Mr. Sunderland's comments in his book on page 62. Dr. Eldredge denied having any opinion about how the DNA code for the first cell could have happened by accident. He said, quote, "I have no opinion about that," end quote. Regardless of these seemingly insurmountable problems, evolutionists assume that a single cell spontaneously formed from non-living chemicals and then began to reproduce and make mistakes. They claim that with natural selection weeding out the bad reproductive mistakes and preserving the good, the process could have created the incredible amount of intelligence found in the biosphere. Now that concludes the section of Mr. Sunderland's discussion about the origin of life. And included here, if you have followed, are simply reasonable positions, reasonable conclusions, which indicate not just the improbability, but the impossibility of evolution producing all of the things that we see on the earth. I want to take some random comments here at this point and read them and then make some comments to you about them. Sir Fred Hoyle, again, in The Intelligent Universe, which was published in 1983 on pages 20 and 21, quote, "If there were a basic principle of matter which somehow drove organic systems toward life, its existence should be easily demonstrable in the laboratory." You hear the comment often, well, there are still basic physical processes that man knows nothing about. I am personally very skeptical about that. But be that as it may, if we had some kind of physical phenomenon that could, in fact, drive organic systems in the direction that evolution requires, those things would have been discovered by now. This is the thing that Dr. Hoyle is addressing here. One could, for instance, take a swimming bath, I assume a swimming pool here, to represent the primordial soup. Fill it with any chemicals of a non-biological nature you please. Pump any gases over it or through it you please. Shine any kind of radiation on it that takes your fancy. Let the experiment proceed for a year and see how many of those 2,000 enzymes, proteins produced by living cells, 2,000 being the number that apparently includes all of the enzymes necessary for the life of the cell. Let the experiment proceed for a year and see how many of those 2,000 enzymes, proteins produced by living cells, have appeared in the bath. I will give you the answer, and so save time and trouble and expense of actually doing the experiment. You would find nothing at all, except possibly for a tarry sludge composed of amino acids and other simple organic chemicals. How can I be so confident of this statement? Well, if it were otherwise, the experiment would long since have been done and would be well known and famous throughout the world. The cost of it would be trivial compared to the cost of landing a man on the moon. In short, there is not a shred of objective evidence to support the hypothesis that life began in an organic soup here on the earth. Let me read that comment again. Hoyle's conclusion about this idea, it involves Urey and Miller's work, it involves Fox's work, it involves many of the other men as well. In short, there is not a shred of objective evidence to support the hypothesis that life began in an organic soup here on the earth. Homer Jacobson, in an article entitled Information, Reproduction, and the Origin of Life in the American Scientist, quote, "Directions for the reproduction of plans for energy and the extraction of parts from a current environment, for the growth sequence, for the effector mechanism translating instructions into growth, all had to be simultaneously present at that moment. This combination of events has seemingly an incredibly unlikely happenstance, and as has often been ascribed, to divine intervention. Now, we commented several programs ago about the idea that the evolutionist constantly requires miracles, not biblical miracles, not miracles caused by God, but occult, mystical miracles in order to provide what is necessary for evolution to have occurred. Let me read a comment by a man by the name of Ebrick, Paul Ebrick, in an article entitled On the Probability of the Emergence of a Protean with a Particular Function in Acta Biotheoretica, published in 1985. Why, then, does the scientific theory of evolution hold on to the concept of chance to the degree it does? I suspect it is the fact that there is no alternative whatsoever which could explain the fact of universal evolution, at least in principle, and be formulated within the framework of natural science. If no alternative should be forthcoming, if chance remains overtaxed, then the conclusion seems inevitable that evolution, and therefore living beings, cannot be grasped by natural science to the same extent as non-living beings, not because the organisms are so complex, but because the explaining mechanism is fundamentally inadequate. Now, if I may translate some of that, what he's saying is that evolution is simply fundamentally inadequate to explain all that is necessary to be understood in order for life to occur. Now, these kinds of comments could be reproduced over and over. In subsequent programs, we will look at some of them. But my intention here has simply been to help laymen, believing laymen, people who do not have a background in science, but who have trusted the Lord as their Savior, to understand that the authority, the certainty, the surety with which evolutionists comment, describe, write about the theory of evolution really has no basis in objective information. It is simply the fact that their theory requires something, and they will dream it up and then defend it to the death, and all the time pretend as though it is actual science or actual truth that has been the basis for their conclusions.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson@bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.